Okay. So.
Sir.
Okay, thank you.
What I'd like to do today is introduce very briefly the conditions in molecular clouds. I know this is a slightly broader audience in terms of astrophysics, and then try to focus on the behavior of the turbulence. It's straight up. And behavior of the turbulence in molecular clouds and in the ISM. And for any of you who don't yet know, I'm at the American Museum of Natural History in New York in a newly founded astrophysics research department, which we're trying to let everybody know about.
Is it newly or
renewed?
Before the 60s, there was an astrophysics research department there that had really been allowed to completely die. So yes, it is actually a new founded department. I'm glad someone actually knows the history.
So who was there in the 60s?
I don't know my history well enough myself yet. One of these days I'll go look it up. So we know that stars form in molecular clouds. And specifically, the star formation occurs in the dense cores that are observed in molecular clouds, which occupy a rather small fraction of the total volume, although they have a fairly significant fraction of mass. But we would like to know what determines the properties of these dense cores, and that must be determined by the larger scale structure of the molecular clouds. Very quick rundown of what physical regimes we're sitting in. These things are very cold due to molecular and atomic line cooling, radiative cooling. Densities range from 100 up through millions and all the way up to protostellar densities, obviously, where protostars are forming. But the typical densities that we'll be thinking about are sort of hundreds to tens of thousands particles per centimeter cubed. They're extremely clumpy. As I said, the dense cores are a small fraction of the total volume. They have supersonic line waves and magnetic field strengths, which recent observations are starting to suggest may not be enough to magnetohydrostatically support them against collapse. Now, for some 20 years, there have been essentially two questions that have driven our understanding of molecular clouds. One is, how come star formation occurs as slowly as it does? Typically, if you go look at a molecular cloud and add up the mass of stars compared to the mass of gas, you derive star formation efficiencies of a few percent. Whereas if you look at the collapse time scale of gas at these densities and these temperatures, you would expect to, well, at these densities specifically, you would expect the collapse to occur within a million years or so. The galactic gas system has obviously been around for billions of years. So there must be something that's drastically slowing down star formation. Second, so that's one issue. How do you keep the star formation rate low? Second issue is, how do you explain these supersonic line waves? If these were just random hydrodynamical supersonic flows, that they would dissipate very quickly. The sort of classical, if I may say that, paradigm has been that strong magnetic fields could explain both of these situations. First, the star formation rate could be explained if you were magnetohydrostatically supported predominantly, and you only got an occasional star forming when neutrals could slip through the ions that were tied to the magnetic field and condense gravitationally. Second, it was thought that if you had a strong enough magnetic field, you would be able to explain supersonic line waves as MHD waves that were sub-Alpha and therefore not very dissipative. In this talk, I will show that this second explanation doesn't hold, that even if you have magnetic fields that are strong enough to turn most of the supersonic motions into MHD waves, the nonlinear MHD waves will still interact so strongly that you lose energy nearly as fast as from hydrodynamical turbulence. And second, I will show that strong magnetic fields are not necessary to slow down star formation. Certainly they will, but it's not a necessary condition. Because turbulence alone can give you any arbitrarily low star formation rate while still being non-zero.
Can I ask you at this point, if that supersonic turbulence decays rapidly, how rapidly does it actually decay in terms of the T2Z starting
point? I'll show you.
I'll show you
in great detail.
As usual, 1.2, right? Or something?
1 or 0.8,
Don't worry. So even that was not correct in that sense.
Well, if you go look at some of the original papers, they actually were aware of it, but then it was adopted, I think, by the astrophysical community as being, once you put in a strong magnetic field, you get very slow decay, with an appeal to linear alphane waves not having dissipation.
Yeah, which is wrong, of course. But the other thing is, as well, of course, that supersonic turbulence still decays only like 1 over T.
Yeah.
So why did people say
So if you actually put in an initial spectrum of turbulence, most of the energy is lost before you reach that kind of asymptotic law.
The asymptotic law of 1 over T. Well, even, actually, I'm going to address these issues. Because specifically I'm going to address how quickly this turbulence decay compares to a free fall time. I agree with Eve.
So it's not supersonic then?
No. She's saying that you actually can decay faster than 1 over T initially.
Yeah.
And in some sense, I think I agree with that. I do agree with that. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was clear. I'm continuing to give you a broad outline. I will go into detail later on. But if the observed motions can't be supported, then we're going to have to ask how to maintain them, how do we derive them. And so that's all I wanted to say on that. Okay, let's keep turbulence support aside for later consumption. Okay, the computations that I'll show are primarily done with Zeus 3D, which is a second order Van Leer advection code with artificial viscosity. And we are primarily using periodic boundary conditions in a cube, so uniform grid, three dimensions. When we have a magnetic field, we always initialize it with fixed flux in the z direction, and the only thing we change is the strength of the field initially. The magnetic field is evolved using constrained transport and the method of characteristics, which I didn't put up here, but Hawley and Stone 95 is the last word on the MOC method. And we didn't use these for now. Okay, so first of all, let's talk about the decaying turbulence models. So we did both MHD and hydro cases, and we focused on supersonic and sort of transalphanic models, although we did a number of other cases. The initial conditions are uniform density Q with periodic boundary conditions. Our velocity perturbations were a Gaussian field. We used a flat power spectrum from K equals 1 to 8 because it turns out that the initial conditions, the only thing that matters in the initial conditions is if you pick out a particular scale. This whole idea of a 1 over k squared spectrum being intrinsic to supersonic turbulence probably comes from the fact that if you take the Fourier transform of a shock you get a 1 over k squared spectrum out. That is, Fourier transform step function is 1 over k squared. So you take a box full of shocks, you get a 1 over k squared spectrum out. A field of Gaussian perturbations with a 1 over k squared spectrum doesn't actually look like a box full of shocks. That is, the phases are uncorrelated in the Gaussian perturbation spectrum, and they're strongly correlated in step functions. So in the end, we just said, well, we're trying to prepare a box full of supersonic turbulence. A flat power spectrum is as good as anything else to get one quickly.
But isn't the case that if you start with anything after a little while, you'll set up a whole bunch of shock systems from the syllabus comes in.
Yes, that's the point.
It doesn't matter. This is arbitrary.
Exactly. The point I'm really making is that it was arbitrary, and this turned out to relax a little faster than this because it had more initial power at small scales. Nothing more.
So you said to 8?
8 was the smallest thing we drove with.
0 to 8, or 1 to 8?
1 to 8, yeah.
Out of what?
Out of 256 cubed zone. So we had up to 256 cubes.
That's 128 modes.
Yeah, 128 modes, and we drove the top 8. Okay.
Did you just initially drive it or keep driving it?
In these models, we just initially drove it. In the next models I'll show you, we continue to drive it. Okay. So first of all, we calibrated in some sense. We asked, what is the decay rate of supersonic hydrodynamic turbulence? And remember, we were setting out to address the question of how much does the magnetic field slow down the decay? And the answer is that this power law is very close to 1 over t. If you look at the values, here are the hydro models. 32 cubed through 256 cubed zones. The power law of decline, so that's t to the minus beta, 0.98. And this is a resolution cipher. So you can see that it's converging pretty well to that value, plus or minus 15%. Now, these were for models started with at t equals 0, the RMS Mach number was 5. So they're really supersonic but not hypersonic once they get into the decay regime, by the time they get into the decay regime. To test whether this might be specifically an algorithmic effect, we also did these same runs with an SPH code. And between this 7,000, 50,000, and 350,000 particles. So between the lowest and highest, there's a factor of 2 in linear resolution in the SPH code, and roughly. And again, we get very similar results. We then added a weak magnetic field, just straight up and down through the box, with the sound speed equal to the alphane speed initially, okay? And the answer was that it does flatten out ever so slightly in this region, but it's the difference between 2 to the minus 1 and 2 to the minus 0.9. This is probably important if you're trying to diagnose detailed turbulent behavior, but it's probably not important astrophysically. That is, the weak field case decays pretty much as fast as the hydro. And we then put in a strong field with an initial alpha number in the flow of unity, so the alpha speed is 5 times the shock speed. And we're clearly not as well converged. However, if we look at the one question that I was really asking, which is, what is the slope? Okay, here's the strong field case, alpha number unity. And at low resolution, we're decaying quite slowly. As we increase the resolution, we decay quicker and quicker. And you can see we're, you know, at sort of plus or minus 5 or 10%. And we're actually converging towards the higher numbers.
By the way, when you say there's no convergence, that's really only with respect to the initial startup phase, where you get most of the difference. because later on the slopes are very similar. I mean,
okay. That's right. Well, I see what you mean. Here, you're saying that there's a definite. Actually, that's a good point. Yeah, because the point is these slopes are all the same, but we're not well resolved in the initial. So
somebody was making a complaint at the conference, but that's Mr. Senning, so to speak.
Yeah, no, that's a very good point, actually.
Yeah, but you're losing most of your energy in that first place.
But we're not trying to measure that. Yeah, but you could probably fix that by some touch factor.
Quite possibly.
Make the low resolution models stronger turbulent initially.
Yeah. I mean, the point we're making here is that we're only asking one question, which is what is the decay rate once it's been prepared? Because the point is, out here at t equals zero, we've prepared an entirely artificial state. So we need to relax over into something more realistic before we can even start asking the question we want to ask.
How do you know what's more realistic?
More realistic in the sense that it's not artificially prepared, but freely evolving.
Conforms to your bias better.
What's that?
Conforms to your bias better.
No. It's more than that.
It's clear that you can have states that decay very differently.
It's clear that we can have states that decay very differently, but we cannot evolve into those states as well as out of them. In other words, I can show you many ways to evolve to this state. I can start with many initial conditions and get there. I can show you no ways besides putting it in by hand to evolve to this state here. That is my Gaussian perturbations.
What do you mean?
In other words, I don't know of any way to, besides setting it up by hand, to evolve to a state of supersonic Gaussian perturbations. Okay? Whereas I know many ways to evolve to this state. Many different sorts of initial conditions will come to something very similar to it. That's what I mean by more realistic.
But that's much weaker turbulence by the time you get down to there, then, I guess.
That's certainly true. But we've also done runs that started at Mach 50, where we went through the initial evolution at very high Mach number, so that by the time we were down here, it was still supersonic turbulence. And we get roughly similar. We actually get slightly steeper decay out there. So, in fact, the point that we're coming in through the transonic, or certainly under the transalbanic regime, is probably significant. I agree.
Yes? I did realize before that all these are isothermal modes, and I was wondering if by forcing them to be isothermal, you're not forcing also the cooling to be extremely fast.
You are.
We are.
But if we just go to an adiabatic model, gamma equals 1.4,
and you got basically the same. No?
Right. We got the hydrodynamic case actually decays a little quicker. Probably because you've got a greater filling factor of flow. You're not collapsing everything into layers that can freely move around sometimes. In the MHG case, again, you get slightly faster decay with the adiabatic case.
I just want to understand, maybe you're going to show us a picture. If I made the field really strong,
really strong.
Right? Yep. So that it's completely subalpine. Then one would expect the decay to be due to cascade of alpine turbines.
Correct. I have not attempted to
you'd expect a combination of that plus pure shock along the
I was coming to that. Yeah, you can have sound wave shocks along the field, but now let's tangle the field.
But you can't really.
No, but if you tangle the field, then it can't be strong.
And very tangled.
Right. You're stuck. Because a very strong field is exactly one that will fight back.
No, you can construct all kinds of equilibria that are tangled.
It strikes one as unlikely that it would be highly tangled and very strong.
Yeah. At least remember that we're in a freely floating. There's nothing to tie the field to set up one of these equilibria.
Sorry?
There's nothing to tie the field to set up one of these equilibria. We're in a free gas.
Well, why do you start with a smooth field? I mean, it's probably not a smooth field.
Of course not. But we prepare, basically, what we do is we prepare a non-smooth field by perturbing the smooth field quickly. Now, we haven't studied the extremely strong alpha turbulence case. However, Jason has.
would you care to comment on decay rates of turbulence in very strong magnetic fields?
Pretty much the hydrogen situation applies for the decay rate.
So it's a very simple, in terms of, yeah. It looks different, but that's absolutely
the same force, the velocity is smaller.
But the decay rates are not drastically different. And for the astrophysical question that we're asking here, the decay rates are the interesting question.
Mordecai, when you parameterize the decay rate in terms of the relation between the energy spectrum and the decay rate, the Kolmogorov constant, you know, the value between 2 and 3. Right?
If we took straight, let's see, how does it work? Now, if you take the Kolmogorov, I think you get T to the minus 1.7, don't you? Or 5.
T to the minus 2.
Oh, okay. No, T to the minus 2 sounds right.
Oh, but you're constraining the outer scale.
That's right. Yes. No, that's certainly an issue. But those are steeper decay rates.
But this is a local situation where you just take the magnitude of the kinetic energy of the scale and the flux of cascading energy in there.
Oh, okay. So we're integrating.
You don't have to worry about this T to the minus alpha stuff.
That's right. We're doing an integral spectrum of all the energy here.
But the hydro value, the subsonic hydro value, is known to be 2.
Right.
The MHT value is 3.5. And you told me once before, the supersonic thing is also similar.
And just to remind you that Stone-Mouse Striker and Gammy have gotten very similar results.
Mike, I rather late, so did you show how the spectrum evolved with time?
I have not.
And do you have that?
We can derive it from our models, and we actually have done, we've published a paper where we show how the spatial distribution of power evolved over time using wavelet transforms, Maklow and Osikoff. And the answer is, actually, I will get to that a little later. Very briefly. But it's not, it hasn't been our dominant focus. Okay. So let me move my focus to the driven turbulence models. And I'm still going to be really asking questions about can turbulence be useful in supporting clouds against gravitational collapse? If that's where I'm going with this. So you say physics. Now what we did was a very naive driver. We just took that initial Gaussian perturbation pattern and kept applying it. We adjusted its amplitude so that the total energy input was uniform. And we actually chose delta functions, essentially, or square and narrow input spectra. So we actually only drove at either large, what we call large, medium, or small scales. That means that we just had a fixed pattern with either only large-scale perturbations or only medium-scale perturbations or only small-scale perturbations.
Varying the phase?
What's that?
And varying the phase and amplitude?
No, only the amplitude. We actually just fixed it.
Spatial phase was locked?
Spatial phase was locked. That's right. I call it naive. There's no question. On the other hand, it's probably just as realistic as varying the phase for something like a molecular cloud, where you may well be driving with point sources of some sort.
Well, but you have, realistically, you have them moving around in time.
Sure, they also turn on and off and so forth. The only excuse I'll give here is that it gives us a very simple thing that we know what input we're giving. I agree that we at some point ought to examine what would happen if we changed the phases.
Can I ask a question about
but I don't expect much.
Gamma equals one. The reason you choose gamma equals one because you feel that radiation will dump the energy and so it's
exactly.
Yeah.
Two.
But one of the questions you could ask is when you start measuring the decay rate, how strong are the shocks? Because obviously you've lost a lot of energy, they become much weaker.
Yeah.
It may be, if you look at the shocks, that a large number of the shocks will not satisfy the gamma equals one idea.
These are dense enough clouds that even a you know small Mach number shock is probably going to cool quite quickly. Astrophysically,
I mean, most of your curve, as everybody pointed out, is in the region of most of the energy.
Well, as I said, we also did Mach 50 runs with no change or marginal change. So that's probably not the main issue there, although it's certainly an issue. And I mean, eventually it would be nice to put in a realistic cooling, but we have to be careful of that because it's very difficult to get terribly realistic because you start to run into non-equilibrium chemistry very quickly.
I think, I mean, it's not that the damming plus one isn't so much an aspect of the shock as it starts out as molecular material. So if you compress it, in fact, you may not be increasing the cooling because you have the line kinds of issues that you may have to trap radiation better.
Well, that's why I wanted to be careful about.
But from an observational point of view, there's not that large a range of temperature in the dense gas. I mean, there are some issues.
There's certainly variations, and we can certainly observe the variations.
As Aideet brought up the other day, that in some regions there may not cool very rapidly.
What is the initial decay timescale? Didn't mention that.
Let me get to it with these models.
Okay.
So we did some driven turbulence models. And now what we're doing is we're putting in a specific energy input, fixed and known, and asking what does the energy in the box adjust itself to. Okay, so here's some hydro models. This is just to show you the effective resolution. These are 128 cubed. These are 256 cubed models. And these are, this is decaying turbulence. This is a time sequence. The driven turbulence models don't look that different, however. Okay, so then we were asking.
Tell us what you just showed us. What are the features of that?
Well, I didn't actually mean to show it, which is why there weren't any particular features.
But I looked at this wallpaper and I admired it.
Okay, we're looking at log of density. We're looking at 128 cubed models and 256 cubed models at the same time.
Are those cuts or?
These are cuts through a three-dimensional box. So we're just looking at a cut of local mass density. And these are auto-scaled. So each one is just scaled to its own max. And this is a time sequence. So what we're seeing is that the shocks over time tend to decay away, leaving larger structures, not so thin, that sort of thing. And
time goes in which direction?
What's that?
Time goes in which direction?
Which goes?
Upwards. Right. So how much does the time change?
Time. Oh, the time. Thank you.
0.2, 0.6, 0.1.
Factor by. And let's see, as long as I'm showing you these pictures, I'll show you MHD.
What's the direction?
Right. any guesses? This is one direction, this is the other direction.
This? So they're not shocks along the field, they're actually perpendicular shocks.
Well, you get both kinds of structures. That's a shock along the field, that's a shock sort of. Yeah, but you do get a lot of these sort of filamentary structures parallel to, or semi-parallel.
Especially at later time.
Yeah. So this is actually useful for that sort of insight. And of course, this is along the field where you're sort of rearranging field lines. These fields stay quite straight. They're just small perturbations on straight fields.
What's the strength of the fluid?
This was alphane number 5 times the. Actually, this is, by here, it's probably alphane number 10 or 20 times. Hydro's decaying. I'm sorry. The alphane number and the time speed are staying the same. This is alphane number 5 times. Alphane speed 5 times the shock speed.
Things running down the field at late times.
Yeah, well, you have some of those and some of these.
It looks like you've got a lot of vorticity in the perpendicular
yeah.
Just mixing the density, right?
Yeah.
What do you got?
I haven't measured it, but that's very apparent.
You can interchange field lines in that plane.
Yeah.
So the blue points are
that's very.
No. They can move around like that.
So it's very different from with magnetic field than it is with the...
Absolutely. With, and especially with the strong field. With the weak field, the differences are more subtle. Okay, back to driven turbulence. Sorry, that was a inadvertent side trip. The point that I wanted to make is that we can measure how much energy is dissipated because we measure our energy input and we can measure the energy in the box. So everything else went away. And we can get an equilibrium out of that. So we measured those equilibria. And what we're comparing here is the driving scale times the RMS velocity compared to the energy dissipation rate. The squares are the hydrodynamic models. And what we see is that just as you would expect from a dimensional, a Kolmogorov-like dimensional analysis, the energy dissipation rate is proportional to dq over a length. The relevant length turns out to be the driving length scale. That is where we're putting the energy in. So that was actually quite pleasing because that somehow satisfied the expectation. And we were able to, of course, take this log here and measure the constant. You notice that the MHD cases tend to scatter around the line. And with the number of MHD cases that we were able to afford to run, these were all 128 cubed models, I wouldn't say we were able to derive any particular behavior. These are models driven with different wavelengths at particular field strength. So this is k equals 4 and k equals 8. And this is the hydro value of the dissipation, and we're asking how much does the MHC constant, this is the dissipation constant, how much does the MHD cause it to scatter? And the answer is something like a factor of 2 or 3. And we were hesitant to try to derive any, because remember, at beta equals infinity, we come back down. So to the hydro value. So we're hesitant to derive any sort of behavior from that. Future work may pin that down better.
Is it anything the dissipation rate or something?
It's the constant in this equation. It's that. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's the is a constant in front of the dissipation rate. Sorry?
Sorry, I'm missing something here. Mm-hmm. You're computing the literal dissipation, not transfer of energy to different wavelengths.
Correct. All we're asking is how much dropped out the bottom.
Okay, and then we cascade or anything like that, either down or up.
Well, clearly we do, because we're starting with very well-resolved scales that aren't dissipating much energy, and we're putting energy into scales that dissipate quite efficiently due to numerical diffusion.
But do you have dissipation-free transfer of energy for the different wavelengths?
Presumably, yeah. I mean, we have very low dissipation at well-resolved wavelengths. So above, say, 20 zones, we're quite well-resolved, and there's very low dissipation. Below, once you get down to 2 zones, of course, you have very high dissipation. So getting energy down into that scale is necessary for this to dissipate. If I just set up a uniform flow and ran it through the box, it would go for much longer than this.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be a cascade. It may be just immediate non-local transfer.
Absolutely.
I mean,
right.
Because you know that a large fraction of the energy is being given shock. It's not a cascade.
It's not a cascade in the classical sense. It might be a waterfall.
How do we know that?
Because we can measure that.
How do you measure that?
We measure the amount of energy dissipated by the artificial viscosity. Julie Zuev actually did that for these boxes of shocks in Smith, Maclow, and Zuev. And we actually were able to...
You're way ahead of me on this, completely lost.
Okay.
How do you separate out things that is shock dissipated and not shock?
Okay, well, we know how much energy a shock will dissipate because the Rankine-Hugoniot jump conditions for an isothermal gas tell us that.
how do you identify what's a shock?
Okay, then what we can do is we identify a shock by taking the divergence of velocity and looking for strong negative divergences. And that's how you pick out a shock.
And it's a different criteria. Above,
yeah.
The divergence is above this number, then it's a shock. And if it's below this number, it's not a shock.
Other way around, but yes, since they're negative. But yeah. And the way the code actually picks out shocks is it puts in a viscosity that's dependent on the divergence squared. That's standard von Neumann artificial viscosity. You can go to steeper powers of divergence. So that's a function that will only turn on in shock fronts. And so all we do is we just have to measure that function, and we can learn how much energy is dissipated in the shocks. So that's something that we can just numerically go in and do.
But then there's
the density's gone.
Okay, then there's another way of dissipating energy in your code, is there?
Yes, which is numerical dissipation, which if you wanted to get sophisticated about it, is an ill-defined subgrid scale dissipation mechanism.
But isn't
and you count that into the energy dissipation rate?
Yes.
There's a formula for...
No, what we're actually doing is we're measuring what's the RMS, what is the velocity of each zone in the box, and adding them up. Rho v squared at every zone in the box. Okay, and we can also measure the shock dissipation rate explicitly. And everything that's left over is what goes in, it must go into other forms of dissipation.
And you probably lose half the cup, right?
Roughly, yes. It's a little, the shocks are a little more important in the hydrodynamic case than in the MHD case. Idiot, do you have a question?
I'm still worried with this matter of geometry and the comparison of the dissipation when you increase the resolution. But the geometry of the shocks.
Okay. Well, but I haven't quoted you a shock filling map. I agree that's something we can worry about. But the total dissipation appears to be relatively constant.
And when you increase the resolution, you still find such a result? Or
this result? Yes. Yes.
So did you increase the shocks dissipate?
So you say plus or minus 10%. Yeah.
Shocks dissipate just half the energy?
Roughly.
Roughly?
It's actually more like 60%. Yeah. Depending on the strength of the field.
Is some subgrid...
is due to energy at small enough scales that it's dissipating off the bottom of some sort of linear or nonlinear cascade. I mean, it may be a waterfall rather than a cascade. That is energy going straight down to those small scales.
Meaning it's on scales that you can't resolve.
Correct.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Isn't that
right?
You can't resolve what happens to roughly half the energy.
Right.
Meaning the simulations don't even...
But of course we're not going to resolve it because we don't have an explicit dissipation. We're relying on numerical dissipation to take stuff out the bottom of our spectrum. But that's okay as long as our results don't depend on the strength of that numerical dissipation. And the point is we buried our numerical dissipation by an order of magnitude, by changing the resolution. And we get the same results. So what that's telling us is that we have some sort of effective... this separation between the dissipation scale and our inertial scale.
So you would think of this as some subsonic turbulence behind the shock?
For example. Here.
But it might also depend on the ratio of compressible to kinetic energy that you have in the code. It depends on both, you know, the driving and the gamma of the flow.
Okay, it could, but it doesn't appear to.
Yeah, but in this, how do you drive your system?
I went through that, Gaussian perturbations.
But
you didn't do it purely solenoidal. Well, we didn't do it purely solenoidal. They did.
Yeah.
We got the same answer. It doesn't matter.
Within a reasonable, you know, yeah, if you don't go to extreme situations, yes, but, you know, like, if you start with solenoidal, you get like 25%, 30% of compressible energy. But,
yeah.
You know, if you vary the forcing and put a lot of forcing in potential modes,
it
and you can
matter.
Go up to 50-60% of compressible energy. If you take a very small gamma, you can get also a lot of potential energy.
Right, but the point is that the dissipation rates don't depend on those quantities, at least not very strongly. I'm not going to argue over factors of 10% or even 20%, but I am going to say that this that we're not going to get factors of 3F.
Yeah, you're not worried about 20% now.
No. I mean, we're still asking basic questions about the astrophysics, and I agree that we can change things in detail, but I don't think we're going to change the basic result.
The other thing, let me understand. So you're saying the dissipation is due to the numerical viscosity is the difference between the total loss of energy that you have and the energy dissipated in the shocks. Is that correct? That's correct. But actually, you don't know that that's the only fact, like I was mentioning yesterday. You may have transferred to magnetic modes and then dissipate by resistivity. So you don't know that all of it.
That's right. All I know is it's due to numerical diffusion at some mechanism. I'm not distinguishing, for instance, between dissipation by numerical diffusion of small magnetic perturbations or numerical diffusion of small velocity perturbations. Okay. Because the point is that in the physical situation, we actually have a dissipation mechanism, and it actually does act on scales similar to our grid scale, ion neutral drift. And so if we can get energy down to those scales, physically there's a good chance that we would dissipate it. And we'll try and do simulations with those explicit diffusivities. But I don't really expect that the gross features that I'm describing to you today are going to change.
Going back to Norman's remark before, in the beginning you have a lot of kinetic energy, and then one would expect that the shocks might be dissipating a lot. But as time proceeds, you're losing kinetic energy, the shocks become weaker, and then at that moment, there should be a moment in which most of the dissipation will come from your numerical.
That's no bad trip. But we tend not to run the code that long because it's only a second order code.
So how much it varies from the beginning to the end of the code?
Julian, do you remember those numbers?
Actually, not a huge amount, yeah.
That would be my guess.
I've looked at the fraction of the shock versus the other. The numerical fraction does increase because the shocks are weaker.
Yeah. But until you get completely subsonic.
But that's because I haven't looked at it beyond the point where it becomes subsonic.
Once it goes subsonic, obviously, you don't have any more shock dissipation. I mean, completely subsonic, not just
on
that subsonic.
You're modeling something else, not a molecular.
Well, if you let it decay long enough, you won't have shocks. If you let it decay long enough, I mean, these guys are being hardcore here. They want to let it decay all the way till it's really incompressible. You can do it. There's nothing that'll stop you.
Aside
from
metaphysical
relevance.
When you say subsonic, in the reference frame of the shock, of course you have to be subsonic, but it's only in the reference frame of the shock. So even if it's in a quasi incompressible flow, you can have shocks.
Yes, that's certainly true. That's certainly true, but they'll be very weak.
One question about physical consistency. You're using a dissipation model, which you could say is artificial.
Yeah.
Now, we believe that dissipation is due to collisions between species, right?
Yet
you're using a radiation model, which also is supposedly due to collisions. How do things heat up with the collision?
Yeah.
So you've got this gamma equal one forced on the system, and then numerical dissipation, they're basically physically inconsistent ideas.
No, they're consistent. We're getting both. What you're saying is that when a collision occurs, you get a direct emission of a proton. You have excitation followed by an emission. But you're also getting a viscous drag because those collisions are random. So any collisional system will have both a viscosity and, if it's got excitable particles in it, a radiated loss.
The artificial viscosity is not real.
Of course not.
Okay, so I'm saying
it may not be physically self-consistent, but it is a good cartoon. That is, it will capture the gross aspects of the system we're trying to model. And that's all we can ask from a numerical model, because I buy it to set up a numerical model that captures all the physics in any system. Well, we don't either. That's right. Now, all we're trying to do is capture the gross features of molecular cloud behavior.
And in a sense, I would say that the convergence would be, convergence when you increase the resolution would be telling you that we're not doing things inconsistently.
No, it doesn't tell us that we're not doing things inconsistently. It tells us that we're doing things in ways that will not change the final answer,
yeah,
which is all we can ask. Okay. The astrophysical question is then, what's the difference between the decay time, the formal decay time, kinetic energy over the time changing kinetic energy, to the freefall time. And this freefall time is just a gene's length over its sound speed. So the decay time over the freefall time, if we substitute in that equation that I quoted before, is the driving length scale, 2 pi over k, over the gene's length scale, times 1 over the Mach number, with factors of order of unity. Now, as I said, the RMS Mach number is observed to be much less than unity. This quantity here, the driving scale over the gene scale.
Did you just say wrong? The RMS
is
much bigger than unity.
Thank you. What the man said. This driving scale, this quantity here, was shown analytically to be less than unity if you want to support against gravity by Bonasola et al. And Leopold et al. And if I have the time, I'll show you later to confirm those results.
Oh, well, I think you misunderstand what you have written. It's not the driving length which plays a role for a given scale. We showed that the scale which is important for the turbulent pressure to act is half typically the size scale of the pressure that you want to support. But it's driven by much larger scale.
Okay, if you can get the power, and in fact, the real point is, can you get the power down into those scales effectively?
Oh, yes, so you can say that. It's not just the scale of the structure. It's
okay,
more
that's actually a fair point. So then the question is, let's see, if I made lambda d larger than lambda j, then we could get the decay time large. But the point is that all that large scale power isn't going to be effective for support. So we're really asking about the decay of the power that's smaller than lambda j. You see what I'm saying? The effective driving scale that's of any use still has to be smaller than lambda j. So in terms of the power that's going to support against gravitational collapse.
But you cannot use your description and cut the scale out of your cascade. It would not be that TD.
That's fair. That's fair, yeah.
Don't quote us for that.
What you would like to be quoted for in particular is in the spectrum, you have more power at the small at collapse scale than is needed.
But did you always is determined by the larger scale?
Right. Okay.
Right, but the point is, I guess if I may interject, the point is that decay time of turbulence on a given scale is comparable to the flow constant time on that scale. Most of the power is in the larger scale. The gravitational collapse time is independent of scale. So you compare the flow constant time on the larger scale with the gravitational contraction time, and that ratio is smaller than 1.
That's what I'm trying to do here. And I think that...
Yeah. Depends on the scale, since it's the sound machine time.
But it only, the free fall time depends on the, but it depends on the density. If you
depends
on
the density.
Yeah.
Depends on the density.
Lambda J is just
dependent
on the density.
Density over, but
are we assuming that the decay time is independent?
So if you average over
the decay time is not independent of the driving scale.
Not independent of the driving scale, but there's some other scale that we're interested in for the collapse.
Sure.
Is that right?
Yes.
I'm trying to understand. I mean, I'm not in this business, so I'm trying to understand what you guys are saying.
Yeah.
So there's a smaller scale you're worried about than the driving scale. Is that
well, that's her point. The point is that we might be driving from a much larger scale.
Yeah.
Well, I agree with you, but there are other people who would say that it's protostars, which are smaller scale. So that's why I'm keeping it as an open question.
Why should the scale be
What are the different ideas for the sliding scale?
That's about 10 geographs down. So it's probably better to keep moving. No, we're not doing so badly. We've gone through two of the three topics I wanted to cover. I'm going to skip the effect of driving wavelengths and the change in spectra, so you'll have to come see me afterwards and ask about that. Because we're running out of time here. Because now I want to put in self-gravity. These are just three cuts through a cube. X, Y, X, Z, Y, Z. Well, I didn't do those cuts the right directions, but you get the idea. And we always centered them on the most of the last fragment in the cube.
This is
now driven turbulence.
This is a density, right?
This is again density. Okay, it's driven turbulence, except now we actually put in self-gravity.
Well, it's the modified self-gravity, it's 4 minus 4
naught. Yes, exactly, because this is the periodic boundary condition. So we're using the Hughes chi.
What is the G's length for the whole box?
In this case, let's see. The turbulent G's length is greater than the driving length, which in turn is greater than the thermal G's length.
What do you mean by turbulent?
We're taking the naive formulation of putting in 1/3 V squared instead of CS A squared.
So that's the G's length in the sense that if
turbulence supported,
okay.
Again,
if it's your angle from more than the
Yes, exactly. Essentially, what we're trying to do is test the validity of this. And Bonasola et al. Claim that it's only valid if there's enough energy at the right scale. I think I'm quoting them accurately now.
So my question was the whole box gravitationally unstable in the absence of
In this case, the whole box was gravitationally unstable because the driving scale is k equals 2, and the G's length is less than that.
Okay.
So the G's length is something like that. I don't remember the exact number for this case.
And those things are really collapsing, or they're just...
They're collapsing down to the scale that we can resolve, and then they're stopping because we can't resolve
anything. By that time, it's contracting violently.
Yes, absolutely. We get strong contraction. Negative dV, all the good signs of collapse. This is just to demonstrate the difference between k equals 2 and k equals 8 driving. So here's our collapsing regions. Okay. Now we did these computations with both an SPH code and a hydro code. And you're going to have to bear with me for a moment because these collapsed regions, we're not going to be able to resolve them adequately. So we have to play some tricks to get any useful information out. Here's the game. In the SPH code, we used sink particles, which are regions that are placed into the model if any smooth particle, SPH is smooth particle hydrodynamics. If any particle gets close enough to a sink particle, it gets swallowed, the sink particle gains the mass so that it doesn't disappear gravitationally, but it no longer participates in the hydrodynamics. Essentially, it's become part of a compact object. In the Zeus models, we simply allow things to collapse to the grid scale. Where they were forced to stop collapsing, we still maintain continuity, but we could no longer resolve the density, the gravitational field well. So the point is that these are two extremes for the actual behavior. In the Zeus case, all our collapse points are bigger than they would physically be. So they're more subject to being destroyed by shocks. They have larger cross-sections. In the SPH case, all the collapse points are smaller and more robust than they would be physically because they cannot be destroyed.
the physical behavior is captured between those two extremes. It certainly will not be, the cores, the actual collapsed cores will not be as fragile as Zeus. They will not be as robust as CH with the zinc particles. So then we can do resolution studies.
Do those cores move around very much?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
More and more massive.
So do you, I mean, what do you do to resolve the unresolved? So is your density above the Klein NL?
Absolutely.
So what do you do about that?
The point is that we don't ask any questions of regions that are within that density, that are above that density, aside from total mass. And all the Klein et al. Tell us the two love criteria.
Oh, so you mean, so anything above that mass scale, you don't ask if it's sub-fragmented, et cetera?
Exactly. Because okay. The true love criterion says that if you want to follow fragmentation, you better resolve to the scale. So we say, okay, then all we're going to ask is total mass. How much mass went into that class C region? We don't know what happened to it after that.
Do I need to know what the true love criterion is?
The true love loves me.
The true love criterion.
So answer the email.
Effectively, you just want to have the gene scale smaller than the gene scale at that at your mass, whatever the mass is in that group.
Because the gene scale goes up with the density, or goes down with the density.
Right.
So you have to keep having enough resolution at your local density peak.
And have people actually done simulations where they locally pack some more points in and keep solving?
Yeah. This was gone into in great detail for SPH models by Bateberger, Bodenheimer, and for grid models by Trulov, Klein, McKee, and maybe some other people.
But it does not take any time scale into account because it depends how long the gas is going to stay.
This is a minimum resolution criteria. If you don't have this resolution, you will not properly resolve fragmentation.
There's also, you're right, there's a time scale involved in it, which is basically the birth time for gravitational, for the gene code, which is short.
Yeah, but you would have to resolve that time scale.
Are these compact objects hit by shockwaves?
Yes. In the Zeus case, it's quite clear that they're being hit by shockwaves, especially at the low resolution in this case is much less compact than the higher resolution. And you can see them getting destroyed by shocks. Okay, in the higher resolution case, they weren't as fragile. And you tended to have a total mass that was better behaved, although not well behaved, but better. Okay, notice that this is sort of 7%. Okay. In the SPH case, we're getting as high as 70%. Okay, so this is the Zeus case down here, sort of under 10%. So our bracketing procedure appears to be effective.
Okay, back to 10.
100%.
Yeah. However, remember that the observed star formation rates are in sort of class and clouds are a few percent. So these sorts of numbers are actually still quite interesting. This is where a particular driving strength goes. I'll show you the behavior with different driving strengths. If I included it in my talk. Well, I may have to go through the work, which will probably mean that I won't show it. But for different driving strengths, of course, that's not it. I intended to include different driving strengths. The point is that for different driving strengths, you can get anything from that to that. Let me not say any more about this right now because I want to give you the answer. The point is that we're trying to support a gas with supersonic motions, an isothermal gas. And we're going to support it by, anytime you start collapsing, having some motion come through and sweep you away. Sweep away that density enhancement.
What does that mean, sweep it away?
Disperse it. Prevent it from collapsing. The
criterion for global support is then going to be the collapse time versus the travel time. And that's what the Chandrasekhar turbulent genes mass really says. Okay, just like the straight genes mass is just allowing pressure waves to disperse gravitational condensation. Now that appears from our results to be a good criterion for global collapse, that is getting all the mass in the box into one, into a compact object. But it appears not to be a good criterion for local collapse. And the reason is that those very supersonic motions that you're relying on to support against collapse also produce strong density enhancements. In fact, density enhancements proportional to the square of the Mach number. Okay? Well, the gene's length is proportional to 1 over the square root of density. That is directly inversely proportional to the Mach number. So as these strong shocks sweep through, you're dropping the gene's length by factors of the Mach number. Even if you have enough energy at the global scale to support, you won't have enough energy necessarily at the local scale. So those pieces can still collapse. The end result is that you get you can get, in a broad regime, isolated collapse for while you're still maintaining global support.
Okay. Somehow this regards geometry, because I mean shocks it is something like this. And collapse you need something like that. And actually shock resists when you try, you know, from a shock front to create something like this. It's
no problem.
Just by saying that you are increased density in a shock, it's not enough.
It's not enough, but
it's a matter of geometry.
This is a sort of tabletop physics way of looking at it. Of course, there's more details, but that's why we do nonlinear computations. And the nonlinear computations give us the answer that these scales that I've outlined to you in a back of the envelope way are in fact the correct scales to look at. We've done a model in which we actually drove hard enough and at short enough scale that we had energy below the shock scale, and that one didn't collapse at all. It was flatline, zero collapse regions for the whole run. So we've actually tested this back of the envelope criterion and found it to be in agreement with the nonlinear behavior. Okay.
One would have thought it was shear motions that were the most dangerous to put on the car.
I'm not arguing.
Vertical motions.
So I'm not arguing.
The most dangerous what?
The shear motions, the
sure.
Vertical motions.
It doesn't matter. The point is
putting apart the car.
In other words, to prevent collapse.
Oh,
it,
yeah.
The point is, it doesn't matter.
The
vertical motions, if they have to be supersonic. And those supersonic vertical motions will produce compressive motions immediately. That's well known. And those compressive motions will in turn produce the density enhancement. So I don't care if it's not the shocks themselves that are.
It's the vorticity works, you know, the shearing rate is bigger on small scales than it is on large scales. So the thing that will rip it apart fastest is the smallest scale.
Yeah. I'm not arguing. But that doesn't preclude this mechanism from working.
Sure, but that's sort of the balance, isn't it, somehow? I mean, to determine how many of these you have, you've got to look at where you can beat the vertical ripping apart.
If the point is that it appears from our results that putting in the RMS velocity gives you the right number.
What does that mean, right?
The number that determines whether or not collapse occurs.
How is your turbulent velocity related to the shock velocity?
The RMS turbulent velocity is a good measure of the RMS shock velocity. Individual shocks, of course, will vary around that.
By shock velocity, you mean the velocity jump, or the velocity of the shock propagation?
The RMS is going to be the same. The details for every shock will be different.
In this simulation, you do see a lot the forcing scale.
Absolutely. we put it in hard. I mean, we put in a spike, right?
Yeah, so it does not evolve clearly. It does not evolve clearly.
The forcing scale doesn't evolve. In these simulations, we're forcing at a particular scale, so no, it doesn't evolve. In decaying turbulence, the dominant scale does evolve. However, then you can ask the question of what's more realistic. And that's an astrophysical question that we can argue. Well, you could ask. I would think it would be an interesting question to ask. So, if you wish to ask it. However, I think at this point...
Well, let me just ask a numerical question. If I ask you how much mass is in boxes of... where is the 80% mass point? Mm-hmm. How many cells, for example, if I look at a typical number, mm-hmm. how many cells is 80% of the mass contained out of 256 cubic?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're going to tell me a very small number.
Correct. Well, no. At this point, I'm going to give you a fairly large number.
No, but how many?
But later, in at this point,
yeah.
I'll give you a smaller number.
0.3%.
Oh, that's time.
Yeah, that's right. It depends on. But at some point,
that's what I'm saying.
Certainly, if we get global collapse, I'll give you a very small number.
Yeah, 256. Well, what I'm getting at is that. When, this is a matter of, when you're making a decision about whether you're going to get collapse or not, well, we're already numerically unresolved terribly.
Yeah. All we're asking is, do we start collapsing? We don't ask, do we finish?
What I'm saying is, when you start collapsing, we're already
numerically unresolved. Oh, I do. Yeah, no, that's actually, the point is, you've got a region like this, which is some small subset of the total grid, which is like this. And that region, we're then asking, okay, what is collapse? Luckily, we found that we could get away with terribly under-resolving turbulence and still get roughly the right decay rates. So it's probably not as bad a problem as you might think. In other words, you could say, well, you're badly under-resolving, so you're just dissipating away all your turbulence much too quickly. And the answer is, we've already shown that if you're not driving the turbulence at that scale, you're probably going to dissipate it away in less than the collapse time anyway. So, as I said, for the answer that we're trying to get out of this, and we're trying to be very coarse here, we're not trying to ask questions, we're trying to not ask questions that we can't answer. But for the question that we're asking, we're probably getting an answer that's good to within a factor of 50%. And for the application that we're doing, that's what we need. Because we're asking the question, should we see stars or should we not see stars in that molecular cloud? And the answer is, we should see stars, but only here and there. So you see, at that level, I think our numerics is adequate.
I think you're not so under-resolved in the following sense. If you look at the gene scale at the density for a Mach number of compression, that is, the density which is the mean density, well, the gene length is reduced by a factor of the Mach number. So if it's Mach 10, you're reduced down to I don't know what your gene length was originally in terms of how many cells.
Yeah, let's see. This was, do we have that?
256
These were gene lengths of around 40 zones maybe, 50?
40, so if you reduce...
So in the dense region we have the gene length of 12 zones.
12 zones, so that's not so bad.
Okay, I think I'm going to say thank you for the formal talk part, and we can continue the discussion as long as we want, but anybody who wants to leave at this point should feel free.
Thank you.
I think you're also answering the question, not only why do you get stars, but why doesn't the whole cloud collapse into a flame or something?
Exactly.
Going back in history, my mentor Fred Hoyle introduced the idea of fragmentation. You had a gravitational anomaly being dropped out down the cloud, and the atom collapsed, and then he established the kernel, a gene length goes down. And then, without analyzing the dynamics, you get fragmentation.
That's right.
Later, Christopher Hunter did a dynamical study putting in a perturbation, and indeed, you find that if you wait for a gene's then the perturbation gets large. I remember Freeman Dyson saying, I don't believe you're going to get stars by the skin of your teeth. Now, what you seem to be doing successfully is finding mechanisms out of that magnetic field for holding the clouds of the whole earth
than allowing local. It's closer to genes variation than civil war.
And but it's a further implication. But Leon, there's a further implication of this, which is that if you don't support a turbulent light, then what I think you're saying is soil type collapse takes over, and the whole thing goes in, and we observe those.
Mm-hmm.
They're called regions of runaway star formation or disturbers. Mm-hmm. So that is also an anthropologically relevant regime.
Yeah. Okay. So. Subcondensations can form in a galactic medium, but it doesn't go into the nonlinear.
That's right. And Klassen and Burkert showed that if you start with a turbulent regime and just allow it to collapse without giving it any more driving, then you get, 60, 80, 100, well, not 100, but 90% star formation rates, and that the properties of the resulting cluster will then be determined by whatever leftover turbulence there was. But that's a starburst. It's not a class.
And on the question of decay, again, going back into ancient history, after Leibniz-Spitzer and I had written a paper on adipose diffusion, we were still worried possibly the conditions would not be appropriate, as it turned out, in fact, in H1 cloud. And so I thought, well, maybe you can hold the cloud up longer than fecal time by turbulence or never mind where it comes along, giving the field more time to slip out. But then I did a simple, naive calculation from taking a page from Cold Coral. Now the turbulence is strong enough to hold the cloud up, if it is strong enough to hold it up, then if you say that the decay of the turbulence is determined by the eddy turnover time, then you divide the eddy, compute that for the largest scale, then you get the free-fall time. On the other hand, if the turbulence is weak, then you get a longer time, and you're not holding it, so you have to hold power up, the headline wind tails you lose.
Exactly. All we're doing is coming around to the same result with a slightly bigger computer. But we're coming back to the same result. I mean, some of these early treatments, you read them and you say, gee, they're modern. I mean, Larson 1981 is another case in point of that, a slightly more recent case. But
it's
very
comforting to a dinosaur.
Sometimes the dinosaurs are right. And now we can start asking, well, what is driving the turbulence? Because it appears that there are regimes of turbulence of work. And we can go through much and much on that.
So how about now the question that you raised, what prolongs the, what makes the star formation ineffective? Isn't it the vorticity that you don't really have, that you have too much angular momentum and can't collapse that angular momentum?
That's probably not a significant issue, because that's not a significant issue. I'm sorry, what?
Well, it's not part of the clouds.
Okay, no, the point is that if you're collapsing, I'm sorry, I'm trying to carry on two conversations at once. If the cloud is collapsing, if you have enough mass to really run in a supercritical collapse, you've got enough mass to set up non-axisymmetric spirals and stuff in the collapsing region and get rid of angular momentum fairly fast.
Yeah, well, if it has more than it can bound. That it can hold.
Is that possible?
That it can spin so fast locally that it...
That will work for a short time. And it'll work if you have an isolated disk, but if you're piling mass on the disk, eventually it'll become self-gravitated and unstable to the spiral modes. And we're not resolving anywhere near to that level.
So what is then your answer why self-formation is just a few percent?
It can be any number you please. It depends on the strength of the turbulence. In our case, what I would say is that when we look at something like Taurus, that's a well-supported region. Whereas when we look at something like Orion, that's a not very well-supported region that's undergoing runaway collapse.
Now, one thing that just occurred to me is here you're driving wave number plays an important role because it's kind of depending on what wave number you're driving. Scales lower than those scales can collapse and scale large enough the way driving by numbers not mm-hmm. mm-hmm. But in the reality, you don't have forcing everywhere in space. You have forcing which is
that's
localized.
Right. That's right.
So really, you don't.
And in reality, what we see is that some regions are supported and other regions go ahead.
Exactly.
Collapse. I'm sorry, T. Was there anything that we should be talking about?
No, he was asking me to. He was asking me, I'm a theorist, so I need you to tell me how I should write down the problem of star formation in simple terms. So I said, it's not simple. There is a feedback of star formation in the status of it's exactly that. And so he didn't want to listen to what I was saying. It's non-linear, so he said, I can solve analytic equations which are
non-linear. Talk to yourself. And many others. Yeah, they're just not necessarily as useful as we would like.
We didn't get to point them, sorry.
No, that's
an astronomy.
Olivia,
yeah.
Who's 3-4 times, let's say, just from a day view. And he said that was a problem because star formation efficiencies are low.
Yeah.
I mean, if you have these big clouds, they do collapse.
Yeah.
Maybe they only a small fraction form stars, so you don't need to form.
That's what was disproven by Klessner and Berger.
Is that right?
They actually took a number of different initial conditions. The first one was they just took a fractal density distribution and no velocity perturbations and let it go. And they got, 68% star formation efficiencies. And the point is that that's expected because any turbulence generated on the way in will then be quickly dissipated again. So then they took a region where they gave it a strong kick, supersonic velocity perturbations, but didn't keep driving it and let that collapse in. And, I think you can guess what the answer is going to be. The turbulence decayed, and then they had density perturbations, and those density perturbations collapsed in, you got 68% star formation rate. And that was, I think, their 99 paper. And then Klessner and I and Fabian said, okay, let's drive it. Let's keep putting in energy somehow, magically, uniform driving perturbation. And the answer is that, okay, now we can set the collapse rate to anything we place by driving it hard enough.
Several of your stirring mechanisms depend on forming stars at some place, and they're extracting energy out of there.
Mm-hmm.
So isn't there a sort of a feedback? You generate more turbulence, hold that bit up, while somewhere else you get collapse.
That would be true if those feedback mechanisms were effective. My current guess, based on numerical simulations that I don't feel ready to show the world yet, is that they're not going to be effective. Meanwhile, numerical simulations that we're getting ready to show the world suggest that supernova-driven driving may be quite effective, which is a feedback mechanism, but on a much larger scale. That's okay. In fact, you probably want to blow the clouds away because they have rather short lifetimes, it looks like. That's another astrophysical argument. But the lifetimes of the clouds, I can find you people who will vehemently argue for anything from 5 to 100 million years. I happen to think that the 5 to 7 million year argument, which is actually kind of the newest, is the most convincing. The mainstream of the community thinks 20 to 30 million years, and there are a few sort of holdouts who are still arguing for 100 million years.
This argument goes along the same lines as what I was saying before, though. Now, if you think of driving from distant sources, then I don't know what is the meaning of the driving wave number. Because now you have shock fronts going around things.
The only reason we're including driving wave number is that tells us how fast things are decaying. Because most of your energy is near your driving scale. Now, in fact, you're stuck at the bottom of some MHD cascade that, because of cooling in the molecular cloud, still produces supersonic turbulence well down. The point that I didn't get a chance to make during the talk is that anti-magnetic field doesn't actually support pulling against collapse. Okay? Never mind the convergence properties, but just noticed that we're, well, we're less collapsed than the NHC.
Can you use extrinsic?
This is, again, the total amount of mass in collapsed objects versus time with hydro case and for the MHD case for a particular set of parameters. And the MHD case is around, you know, 5 or 10%, whereas hydro case is getting up as high as 40%.
Why does it go down?
That's where Shaman Report is destroyed.
Is that time or is that 3-4 time?
In time in terms of total amount of mass.
Okay.
You know, that first curve there. Is indicative of no convergence.
This one here?
Yeah, right, because.
Yeah.
I mean, what you're really saying is.
Well, actually, okay, let's get into that one. I skipped over this in the first part, but there's actually a lot to say about that. Let me show you an interesting convergence thing that I didn't really talk about in detail. This is what the SPH does. So remember, this is with thick particles in it.
When we did you say thick particles?
Sink.
What does that mean, sink?
They are a sink, not a source for particles.
SPH is good for particles.
Right. Okay. Let me explain the thick particles again. Any place where there's a region of strong convergence and high density.
Yeah, it's like a black hole. Correct.
It's a black hole.
Okay.
Exactly. All carries, retains its mass.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So this is with the same particles. And really all M star over M here just measures the mass of the same particles. Okay, so first we did a resolution study. B2L was 20,000 particles, B2 was 50,000 particles, B2H was 200,000 particles. Now remember, of course, that the linear resolution is the cube root of these numbers. So from 20,000 to 160,000 is a factor of 2 in linear resolution. But SPH computation was so low to do these intermediate stages because particle numbers explode. Never mind. Anyway, so you see that B2L to B2H, which is a good factor of 2, they actually have quite similar behavior. And one might be tempted to say, oh, well, we're not badly converged. B2 had somewhat different behavior, and we were sort of saying, well, there's no clear trend of convergence. Why is that? And then we had a nasty suspicion. B2, A, B, C, and D are all runs at the same resolution as B2, that is 50,000 particles. The only difference is the random numbers used to set up the driving condition. So we've just shifted the phases around for the driver. As you can see, the cosmic variance, that is just changing the properties of the driving function, for this chaotic process, significantly exceed the resolution effects.
By the cosmic, you mean just changing the phases.
Yeah.
Because the forcing.
Exactly.
But you don't really know what the forcing is.
Exactly. So what we can say is that forcing will give us a certain behavior. And we can also say that small changes in the forcing can give us this type of variation. But we can still say that in the presence of forcing of the strength, we will never go down to 0 or 100 threefold times the first collapse or something like that. And as I said, for the questions we're asking, that's sufficient. And that's why when I look at something like this, I don't say, my God, that's terrible. I say, not too bad. We could do better, but it gives us a basic point. Because, you know, that drop, that's pure chaos. It could have come here, it could not come at all. But this...
You could also say your run isn't long enough, statistically.
Sure. If we wanted to capture those statistics. But the qualitative result we can capture, that's really all we can argue.
But here's no SPH in this comparison.
This is Zeus against Zeus.
Yes. So do we have similar experience?
Yeah.
Kind of an initial condition for this?
We haven't tested it, but we would certainly strongly expect it. I mean, there would be no reason not to.
Well, we did. Oh, the MHD.
Oh, that's right. No, you're right. That's right. No, he did do that. It's in Heitschmeichel and Plassen, which he can give you a copy of. Unfortunately, I don't have a view graph of it.
in your MHT case, the, you have a large scale field.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, and you got MCI, I presume, is the critical mass for.
MCR is the critical mass for a collapse against its magneto hydrostatic support or not.
Okay, right. I'm wondering whether do you have any evidence of preferential flow down the field lines?
Okay.
Which you'd expect.
Yeah.
And which.
There's the.
Yeah.
Yeah. Certainly in the decaying case, what you tend to get is you set up filamentary structures with field in them, and then you get flow down the filamentary structures. And Balsara and Bouquet have emphasized this. In the driven case, it's rather less clear, especially in the, well, this is a case with B over B crit of 1/4. So this is not what, it's a factor 4 away from support, pure support. Just to show you what support looks like. These are regions that didn't collapse, okay? They just formed sheets. And you can guess which way the field is.
The time evolution?
No, these are just three XYZ.
Okay.
So the field is like this, like and then like this. And then we're looking that way. Okay, so that's actually what you would expect. It's not accretion along field line so much as accretion into sheet.
Well,
yeah, that is accretion
along field line.
Yeah, of course.
Another point, in all the discussions a couple of weeks ago, last week I mean, angular momentum hardly come up at all. When I was young, angular momentum was one of the issues.
Right. There are two things that have happened.
Within formation of cloud, but also within.
Right.
If the front begins to collapse, if it did concern angular momentum, you run into trouble. Perhaps not.
Well, there are two developments.
I'm just wondering.
There's two developments. The first is that, which is actually quite old, but I think not completely appreciated, is that these spiral density waves have been shown to be quite efficient at transporting angular momentum. I think Xu did that back in like the early 80s. And that's true for self-gravitating disks. I think that gets overlooked by the star formation community because when they go out and look at things, they never see self-gravitating disks. And the reason is that self-gravitating disks are very efficient at clearing their mass and collapsing into a star. So once you start going in a supercritical fashion, you have this very efficient spiral mechanism that shoots all your mass onto the star. In the absence of self-gravitation, that is, if you've got a less dense disk and you're still trying to accrete mass in some sort of more or less equilibrium fashion, that's where we now have a physical mechanism for that as well, which is these magneto-rotational instabilities, the Baldassare instabilities, which got discussed rather extensively for that reason.
In reference to your point, though, if you do simulations with small and larger magnetic field strength, and you let it go for a long time, you see these little disks form if you have a weak magnetic field, and you don't if you have a stronger magnetic field, because
of
the magnetic torque.
Yeah,
yeah.
Right.
On these large kind of cores, yeah.
No, I just wonder whether, in fact, if you want to be pure Italian and allow yourself the luxury of in the magnetic field, whether turbulent viscosity, is also transporting angular momentum.
Okay, in the absence of magnetic fields, the self-gravity mechanism will still work, but you might end up with long-lived accretion disks. You might not get long-lived accretion. You might only get prompt accretion and then accretion of low angular momentum mass after that.
But is there any turbulent transport from the contracting body to the rest? Like from my thing you used to talk about here.
It's not clear. Certainly in an accretion disk, turbulent transport is ineffective. That's what John Hawley spent the last decade.
Yeah. Well, you want to generate turbulence, magnetic field.
A weak magnetic field is quite effective at generating turbulence.
But then, on the other hand, to make these pores and everything, you probably you're concentrating the magnetic field.
Yes, and if you're super, the point is you can't really without reconnection you can't change the mass flux ratio. And if you start out with a supercritical
field in space. If you start out subcritical, you stay subcritical, and yes, it's critical. The points that we're making is that, first of all, subcritical fields produce unobserved morphologies. They require fields that are rather stronger than are observed. Bobby, you look unhappy. Do you think that these are observed?
No, not these, but this is a very extreme case.
That's not that extreme.
But it even works with 4.8.
Oh, okay, that's
kind of an increase.
Yeah.
By the way, is D divergence or what?
D.
Density.
Sorry. We try to go with relatively simple physical quantities when we can. And it's not the final point is that the supercritical fields aren't required. Also, the behavior of the star formation behavior doesn't appear to agree with the supercritical case.
So if I say critical, you mean?
I'm sorry, subcritical.
Well, which is critical? Is it a mass or the field?
But when I say a supercritical field, I mean a weak field. When I say a supercritical mass, I mean a big mass.
Okay.
And the actually the last point I should make is that the core properties that are observed are inconsistent with being magnetohydrostatic by support. That was Nakano 98.
How are they? Maybe Mordecai, we should finish up and then I think we talked about having a true discussion rather than a presentation next Tuesday.
Right.
So perhaps we should hold the rest of our questions and discussion until then.
About what subject? Same subject?
Same subject.
Yeah. I'm happy to stay here and continue discussing, but again, anybody who wants to leave, we should now give people another chance to blow out. You can also watch videos if you stay.
Oh, video,
yeah. We'll go all these points together, sure.
More than you said that if you put enough drive, you can get something like 5% or 3% efficiency.
Yeah.
So how much drive do you need to put in to get that?
Well, that's a question that if I answered, Norm would justifiably jump all over me. But, I mean, the answer is that you have to put significantly more than just the trying to say our genes turn out. Let me see if I can find the graph that I think I'm saying.
Okay.
And you have to put it in on relatively small scales. I mean, take a look at the head plus and height dramatic well, but.
Is it from the video or what?
I may get to it. Why, is there a demand for it?
No, I have a question.
I was actually. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In the field of hydrodynamics, yes.
Mm-hmm. Actually, you see, you're
at your conference. Did I see that at the conference?
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you get Kunal?
Well, here it is.
Drive it above the gene length, and the driving scale is larger than the gene scale.
Do I get collapse when I drive it? If I drive it larger than the gene scale, I do not get collapse.
Right.
No, I do get collapse. I'm sorry.
No. And I get
collapse.
Yeah. More than the global gene center.
Defined with respect to.
Tell me, what are you doing in there?
Yes.
What? I put on the shop.
Okay, so this is now M fraction of mass.
The global gene scale is still relevant. In the sense that
yeah.
If you.
Fraction of mass.
Yeah.
time again.
Drive
okay,
above
so
the global
yeah.
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 Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Then the significantly less
here's and then these are different driving wavelengths.
Oh, I see. So the more the more little structure you put on, the
less
ambition
becomes that.
Okay, I've been making assumptions.
Uh-huh.
Oh, sorry.
So
sorry.
Somehow, yeah. So
cross the talk.
I think at this point I'll live with it. Sorry about that.
So, if this is somehow a fragment, okay, we put something physical into this.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Might be that whatever is driving fragmentation is more efficient.
Mm-hmm.
So the more fragmentation you have, the less efficient the star formation becomes in this medium.
Well, it's not fragmentation that's the issue here. It's the velocities. It's not the density perturbation. It's the scale at which the velocities vary with those two beams.
So let's say, can you draw a picture of something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can try.
Of
I never turned the power on.
Well, you didn't need
it. No. They'd like to record it.
Have
I see.
The shock front. Has a scale of lambda drive.
Mm-hmm.
And that behind the shock, also the scale of the compression is
lambda drive.
No, that
you
don't
get in here?
Because if you have zero encoding in the gas,
what's that?
It could be
different.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll probably keep talking for a while. If you need to get in here, just shout at us. Okay.
The
point is
that these are all velocities.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and it's just shifting back and forth. The thing
yes.
that determines it. As you start trying to collapse, say in this
region,
okay, you better get a shot through there before it collapses, or a vertical motion or something.
I see.
Yeah, through there. So that's
okay.
The issue. It's not
okay.
The
perfection. So how many times you pass a perturbation through?
No. That's right. That's
so
it.
So the more times you pass through a region. But how do you know?
That depends on the RMS Mach number.
Yeah. No.
Or velocity.
No. But how do you know? Okay. You have the SPH, which is extremely efficient. And then you have the.
Yeah.
I should like the Sluice case, which is basically not efficient because the size of your green.
That's right.
Is making it.
That's right. So what we're doing is capturing the. The envelope.
Yeah, but how do we know
where it is in that envelope?
Yeah.
Well,
because that was a factor of 10.
That's right.
Right.
That's right.
And here we're talking about, well, yeah, in this case we're talking only about SUS, which is going to be inefficient by itself.
Right.
Okay.
The only.
There's a factor that has to be multiplied that will increase this thing.
Presumably.
Yeah.
I mean, here we're already getting up to 50%.
Yeah,
it's not that efficient.
See? But it's less efficient than in the SPH case.
Yes,
the SPH case would make it one right away.
There's the SPH case. Zoom.
Yeah.
It just goes straight up.
Something like that.
Yeah. That's one pre-fault time, right?
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So the point is that we do not have the technology available to actually measure these values. And even if we did, it's not clear how well we would
like
but the cosmic variance may be the most important
What's the cosmic variance
larger than
what I was showing you?
G is less than
This thing you have collapsed.
We took the same, remember I said we took the same run? We did it five times with five different sets of random numbers and we got, you know, that much variation. What are you going to do?
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay.
All you can do is define a broad envelope of collapse rates. You can't
so,
together.
So for reasonable conditions, you know, it's going to be within these range.
Exactly. Now you could compute an average value. If you took, you know, many, many high-resolution runs, you could say, okay,
then
here's the trend line.
Then
that would probably be useful. But it's somewhat beyond our current context.
Yeah, it's saying that,
you know, someone wants to go to a
scale, not just the gene scale.
Or we can wait 5 years until
how much
you have it
by
even if it's high,
supersonic, even if it's
that
region is going to collapse.
You know, that I didn't really pay too much attention. But after our talk yesterday.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Is that a reasonable statement?
I mean, well, I'm
agree with that.
Yeah.
Okay. That's if we take
is it
the base value
mm-hmm.
on the,
if you
on the base of the data that Bruce was quoting,
it might
start to make the first very short. So everything occurs very fast.
Yes.
And then take whatever you were saying.
That might still be true.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Start from the curve very fast. But we destroy the things by external perturbations. Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So somehow the clouds are forced to form the stars.
Well,
it is very efficient
in
now
scale of like one and
in this short time scale against all these external conditions.
That's it.
Right? And how do they know? In other words, what will be setting the star formation efficiency is something that all the solids within this scheme becomes very, very fussy.
Yeah.
Because
the
the star formation rate is determined by the destruction. In other words, it's easy to create regions of collapse. It's the destruction that determines whether
or not it doesn't answer how.
What will happen later?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, gravity,
that's right.
Oh, that's light.
It's not so it will be going to collapse.
Correct.
Then, you know, whatever is driving, the forms are really easy.
Mm-hmm. Because
then,
it doesn't matter how you collapse.
Turbulence, the driving length is larger than
will destroy it.
Right.
Yeah.
And that is not unreasonable if you are expecting driving from outside.
Yeah, exactly.
Huh?
Yeah.
So you're saying that you can't prevent it from collapsing if you study it.
Where is this? In the star formation
that's what
we're
saying.
That is
more or less. We can't prevent the collapse. We
get
temporary star formation.
You get star formation.
But the key point here is
local.
Yeah,
which is particularly
Yes.
Yeah.
Then you need so many
I guess they are ready to come in now. As you said, you would make yourself clear.